independent bar literature festival. Heather's obviously an award-winning writer, journalist, and activist. Our unprecedented five-year campaign for full disclosure of MPs' expenses led to a full-scale reform of the parliamentary expense system. Heather's the author of The Silent State, as you'll write to know, and now The Revolution Will Be Digitized, which explores the most urgent questions of the digital age. Where is the balance, for example, between freedom and security? In an online world, does privacy really exist? And will the internet really empower individuals or usher in a new age of censorship, surveillance, and oppression? These are leading questions. There's more information out in the world, but who, if anyone, is in control? Do we need control? Who owns that information? Governments, Google, Twitter, Facebook, you. The question is central now to everything we do and is done in our name, in politics, economics and diplomacy. The perennial power struggle between the state and the individual has moved to cyberspace, and Heather Brook is in the front line. So welcome, Heather.
Thank you.
And Heather's going to talk us, tell us what you're going to do.
Okay, well, please forgive me, I've got a terrible cold that I'm here in Babylon. But I thought I would try, if my voice holds out, to talk for about 20 minutes, maybe 15, a bit about what I encountered in the book and sort of where we are at the moment. And then
you can ask questions, it's the usual stuff, you know.
So, yeah, so I was here two years ago talking about The Silent State, which is my previous book. And that's what the theme of that book was, this kind of double standard that exists where the private individual going about their private business is transparent to the state, while the state doing public business at public expense is very opaque. And out of that sort of campaign came the MPs' expenses investigation, which I did. And from there, I moved into this new arena, which is really just a following on about this idea of information now being global. I think with the MPs' expenses, what was so revolutionary about that wasn't just about the fact that it was published, it was the way it was published. The reason it could transcend the confines of Parliament was the fact that it had been digitized. It had all been scanned, all of those receipts had been scanned in electronically and then been put onto an electronic database. And it was once they were on that database, it became incredibly easy for somebody to make a copy. And they can make a copy on a tiny drive the size of their thumb, all of the information. And they could then take that and sell it to a Daily Telegraph, for example, which is what they did. So I did a court case prior to that, which led to the creation of that database. Parliament was working very hard to not publish it, or if they did have to publish it, they wanted to redact quite a lot of information. And I think what they hadn't expected was the way the digitization of it had liberated it from their control. So that's where we're now, where we are now in a digital revolution. And that's why I titled, that's why I titled this book, The Revolution We Digitize. And it's called Dispatches from the Information War because I spent about a year researching this kind of frontier, as you said, of information activism. So it was people, some people like me, who are freedom of information activists, but also a lot of NGOs, but also hackers. And we've heard a lot about hackers in the last week, and certainly they're a big part of the book that I talk about. But the idea now, when I say the revolution will be digitized, it means that in the past, information could be contained in nation states, and the way our laws operated were sovereign to each nation. Once information is digitized, it doesn't stop at national borders. It's global. And not only is it global, but it's instantaneous. So the way that the powerful controlled it no longer works. And that's what we've seen in the Arab Spring and all kinds of other challenges to old ideas about power structures. So what I posit to you is that society as we know it is being deconstructed. We're undergoing probably one of the most phenomenal shifts in power since the Gutenberg Press. And when I say shifts in power, I mean power structures that were once hierarchical are now being decentralized. and that's what I want to talk about now.
Great.
This is very awesome. The 18th century English philosopher and social theorist. And he came up with a very interesting idea, which was the panopticon. Now, when I talked to you earlier, I talked about the liberating aspect of digitalization and how it's able to spread globally. There's also a counterpart to digital evolution, and that is that the internet can become a universal spying mechanism, where everything that we do online can be tracked, can be traced back to us, can identify us, can identify what we do. So when Jeremy Bentham came up with this idea of a panopticon, he proposed it to different people. He wanted to do it for different institutions, prisons, but also hospitals, mental asylums. Anyway, he got the list of take-up around the idea of a prison. And the point of a panopticon is that you have authority able to view all of the inmates who know they're under surveillance, but they don't know when, and they don't actually know who, but they know it's an authority watching them all the time. So he pitched this idea, and there were several plans that almost came off, but never quite. And they never came off because the architecture was just too difficult and too expensive to make it happen. So I want to fast forward a little bit. These are a bunch of CCTV cameras in Britain. Now here you can see architecture is catching up with the idea of panopticon. You've got authority watching people. We don't know when we're being watched, we don't know when the cameras are on, we don't actually know who's watching us. But somebody is watching us all the time. And I'm going to bring this to the internet in a minute. But I guess the first thing I want to point out is, why is this bad, this idea of being watched all the time? Because what I'm going to say to you is that on the internet, this is exactly what is in the process of happening. And some people will say, well, this old chestnut that I hear all the time is, you've nothing to fear, you've nothing to hide. I was just reading an essay by George Orwell about the prevention of literacy, which is a fantastic essay. And one of the things he writes about in that is, you can't have art literally. And I would also say, you can't have creative innovation literally. And what he means by tyranny is basically being watched all the time. And it's not just being watched, it's being watched by a vengeful god. And the vengeful god is some authority which has the power to punish you if you stray into, if you go beyond the prescribed orthodoxies of what's allowed. And that is basically what the state is. So initially, when the internet was developed, and really up until quite recently, it was, some people described it, I think you did, as the Wild West. Well, actually, it's not total chaos, but I'd say it's managed chaos. But what it isn't is it doesn't have any central authority. There's no real central authority that controls it. In some states, they've tried very hard to centrally control it, and we can think of some of the more successful states like China or Iran where they've done that. But for the most part, even in places like Tunisia or Egypt, part of the reason that people were able to get their stories out was because it was very difficult to centrally control the structures of the internet. You could have proxies that could bypass filter points, and so people could get their news out. They were still able to speak without being watched all the time. And I think this is a really important idea about the freedom of not being watched. And why is that? It's because it gives you the freedom to speak truths, truths that aren't mainstream, that aren't the prescribed orthodoxy. And it's through being able to speak those truths that you start to change society, and you make society more reflective of what reality actually is. So I have a little video which there's no sound, but it's in Arabic, so I think you can. This is a woman in Saudi Arabia, and she's posted this online. It's about a campaign that started through Twitter of who decided they were fed up with this ban when they couldn't buy a Saudi Arabian passport. And so they had this Twitter hashtag about women driving in Saudi Arabia. And so kind of they were able to sort of meet up on this global space and give each other support. And through that support, it became a bigger movement. And you can see that one of them has posted her traffic ticket. First ticket issued for not having driver's license there. Because you're not allowed, it's not actually illegal for women to drive, but they're not given licenses. You can't give a woman a driver's license. So this is the kind of legal trick that's used to stop them driving without a male relative. But these are the kind of voices that can be heard through the managed chaos of the internet. And if you can imagine, would women be able to do that in Saudi Arabia, in the mainstream media controlled by the state? No, of course they couldn't. Would gay people in Africa make their voices heard in that country? No, they couldn't. Could people in Tunisia, would they be able to assemble together in such great numbers and communicate if all of their communication was tracked and surveyed by the state? Well, they couldn't, of course they couldn't. So everybody knows about Google? So what's been happening on the internet? We've got some sort of managed chaos where it started to distill into some big centers of power, some concentrations into big companies. It used to be AOL, CompuServe, they've all kind of gone out now, and now we have the new giants, Google, Twitter, and Facebook. So the problem here is not so much that they exist, it's the fact that, it's a concentration of information. And what you're starting to see around the world is that states have now wised up to how powerful the internet is. Initially, when Mubarak was first told about the economy, he didn't even understand it, he didn't know what Facebook was, he had no clue. Well, I don't think there's any leader in the world now who doesn't know what Facebook is. There's no authoritarian who doesn't understand how the internet threatens their autocracy. They understand it, they get it. And so what we're starting to see is a great movement with people in power, with governments, and not just autocratic governments, but also the more authoritarian parts of democratic states, so the military and particularly the intelligence services, trying to find ways of controlling the internet, because they don't like this managed chaos. It's unsettling, it's challenging to them. They don't want these voices coming out of nowhere challenging the orthodoxy. And so what you find is that they are starting to put a lot of pressure on big companies, and so starting to use these big companies as sort of de facto intelligence agencies. And what's happening a lot in America is that different law enforcement agencies are making secret subpoenas to Google, to Twitter, to Facebook, for them to hand over all this user data. And the companies are in this sort of catch-22 position. They either agree to hand over the data and piss off their customers, but the customers don't even know, because a lot of these are secret, and it's actually illegal for them to notify the customer that the law enforcement has made a request for their data. Or if they agree, they're compromised in terms of their customers. If they refuse, then the government can make their lives quite difficult. It can start to regulate their industry, it can cut down their market share. So they generally tend to cooperate with the government.
Can you have evidence for that? You have evidence for Facebook giving private information?
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of... Facebook never fights against government subpoenas, but Google and Twitter both have. They've actually gone to court to get the subpoenas unsealed, to allow them to inform the user that the records have been asked for by them. So they've done that. A lot of states around the world see this. They're kind of jealous that America has all these big companies. It sort of seems that it's got an unfair advantage now in the intelligence market. And so increasingly you find that a lot of states around the world are finding ways to control the internet, either putting in filters or blacklisting websites. And this is a survey that's done, I think, every couple of years. It's done by an organization in America called Freedom House. And it's an assessment of free internet. And you can see that it's a bit difficult to see, but the green countries are free, but even that's a little bit, you can argue with that. And then the yellow are partly free, and the purple ones are not free. And what they found is that this number of not free or partly free is increasing quite a lot, and the number of free countries is really coming in, coming down and being challenged. So when information is global, how do nations deal with that? Well, one thing that happens is the bigger, more powerful nations try to extend their jurisdiction. And that's what America's been doing quite a lot with its copyright. And not just, this is a copyright case. This is a website based in New Zealand called Mega Upload. And it's a file sharing site where people who watch movies or they buy CDs, they purchase the thing, but they've agreed to share it with other people online. Well, the American government has a law called the US Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which forbids this. It's a criminal offense to share files digitally. And you might think, well, what does that have to anything to do with New Zealand? Nothing. New Zealand wants to prosecute it, it's in New Zealand, that's their jurisdiction, they deal with it. Well, in fact, no. What started to happen is that in the internet there are some choke points, concentrations of power, and one of them is around the way that the domain names are given out. So a .com is given out by an American agency. So MegaUpload.com has now, the naming agency has said to the provider, you're not allowed to host this site anymore. It's illegal, and we want it to come down. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. The site went down, and then the New Zealand police went and raided the guy's house. His name is Kim.com. He changed his name to Kim.com. And you can see these all across the internet now. A lot of them by America, so this is another one. A lot of gambling sites. Online gambling is illegal in America, but websites, companies based in Costa Rica, based in Europe, the whole web has been shut down. Their whole web access has been shut down by the American government. So here's another one. And now we see the same thing happening in Britain. So now SOCA, which is the Serious Organized Crime Agency, the kind of British equivalent of the FBI, they've also started to do these takedown notices, where they decided that the website is illegal, it may not even be based in Britain, and they've blocked it. And this is one from Saudi Arabia, and a couple more. Well, this last slide. A lot of countries feel now that America has a real advantage when it comes to finding out information, either from the big American companies, Google, Twitter, Facebook, and also in the way that it started to expand its jurisdiction and start to block websites around the world based on what the American government doesn't want. And so countries like China and Russia have decided, hey, we want to have that same power to block websites we don't like and filter. And so what's happened is that in September of 2011, China, Russia, Uzbekistan, and several other countries went to the United Nations and called for a resolution to allow them to change the entire structure of the internet so that it is not, information is not able to flow globally. It has to be stopped at national boundaries so that each sovereign state has total and utter control over its own internet space. And that is being debated right now, which I think is pretty frightening. And that is definitely what I talk about the information on the book, that is the contested territory. The internet is very much this territory that people are fighting over. And I think that's why I hope people read the book and get informed about the situation we're in, because if we aren't careful, I think we have the tools in the internet to create this amazing universal bonded sort of human society where we can connect to people all over the world. But equally, if we aren't careful, authorities and states, under the guise of national security, under the guise of keeping us safe, are going to take over that free internet. It will no longer be free, it will be centralized, it will be under control. So, yes, if you want to be free, as it's already here, then I hope that we're all going to educate ourselves and get active on blocking these government news.
So you're making obviously a leap, and I think people could understand that blocking an infringement of copyright would be fair enough. I mean, we've had debates about books and music, and you know, various artists' copyright about that. But I suppose what you're worried about, what you're making the leap from, is intellectual copyright to government interest.
I think it's the idea that copyright has become more censorship in some ways. There's definitely a sense in the new generation that they want to be able to share information and mash it up. They want to take all these songs, they want to take all these images, and they want to create new art out of it. And I share the frustration in some ways, because if you look at the way the copyright law has changed over time, I mean, it used to be that, I hope this isn't too boring or obscure, but it used to be, if you read sort of like letters between Thomas Jefferson, when they were coming up with the Constitution, one of the things they were trying to do was figure out in the Constitution what their philosophy was about copyright. Because having come from Britain, they understood that copyright was the gift of the monarch, and it was a patronage. And it was through copyright that information was controlled, and they thought that was very dangerous. So they wanted to be able to give creative people a way to make money and be sustainable based on their work, but they didn't want to make it so that they would make it proprietorial for other generations. So they didn't want sort of the old generation to stop the young generation from making new art. And so they came up with an idea of maximum 30 years, which I think is pretty good. But now it's 100, and in some cases even more. So I think. And I think what a lot of young people are so angry about is the fact that they feel their voices aren't being listened to in government, and that government is has been subverted by the recording industry, the movie industry, who pay all these lobbyists to go to the EU or Congress and pass laws that make it a criminal offence to share information.
But I mean, before we get on to the bigger point, I mean, you'd be cross, wouldn't you, if I thought your publisher had sent me this book digitally. And I said to the Sylvia, it's there quite happy. I can still have an email. And there's a book in the interest of free sharing as well.
Yeah, I have this debate with so many hackers, as you can imagine, because they're like, what do you want to be free of book? Surely you're free of information campaign, or why should I pay for it? And I guess what I'm trying to say is, I don't believe that it's. Why should it be free? My time is valuable. I respect what I do. It took me years to write that book. I traveled all around the world. You know, like, it's expensive to do that. Somebody has to pay for that. If they don't, then I don't write those kind of books. Those investigations won't get done. So it's about trying to. But the point is, like, with a book like that, a writer makes their money in the first sort of like 5 years of that book. The problem is though that the copyright will extend for a very long time, and actually a lot of times the author loses out from that. I would like to be able to kind of post chapters on the website or send them or have more people see them. So I think we're in this transitional phase where we have an old business model.
Yeah.
And we haven't quite figured out a new.
Okay, well, before we go to the book itself, which is about Julian Assange, Iceland, banks, all of that, and it's an extraordinary investigation. I just to close off that little presentation you did, or not close off, because obviously it's always open. Have you got evidence of, what evidence is there of government, direct government blocking of private information, or of people trying to expose their stuff? You know, the people in various countries, within China, is obviously completely restricted, and it's hard, but Saudi Arabia seems to be still able to do stuff.
Well, I mean, the technology is around filtering, so when the internet is, the structure of the internet, the cables, it comes into a country, and when it comes in, there is a point where it's, we have cables that come across the Atlantic, fiber optic cables, and it's at that point you can put filters in, and ISPs, internet service providers, can put filters in to block certain websites, or even certain words that can filter out. So the technology, not only is the technology there to filter, but the technology is there to do surveillance. And that's the really frightening point about where we are at the moment. When Jeremy Bentham was thinking about Antarctica, there just wasn't a way to do it. And if you wanted to spy on everybody, with such a huge capital outlay, now you can do it. You can actually survey an entire online population. And because storage is so cheap, it doesn't cost anything. So what you find is that, like the National Security Agency in America, their whole kind of ethos is about sucking up as much internet traffic as they can, and then afterwards figuring out ways to analyze it. So if they have a person they want to look at, they can analyze all the traffic and so forth. But I think this is where we need to be worried, is the fact that we are in a situation where we could be watched at all times.
Do you think you're being surveilled?
It's not, and I think that's
you're
wrong.
You're investigative journalist.
But I think it's wrong to think that very few people are targeted for surveillance. It's just blanket. So all ISPs have to keep our data for, I think it's 5 years. And if the government then decides, that that's a person of interest, they handle the data.
So when you clear your browsing history, when you clear the dodgy websites you or your children have been up to, that's you're not clearing one of them.
No, and I think that was a big mistake about WikiLeaks, and a lot of these hackers, because they thought there was a way, they thought you could remain anonymous on the internet. And in fact, nobody is anonymous on the internet if you have enough resources, which a government does. I mean, I don't have the resources to try to track who everybody is, and so they remain anonymous to me. But certainly the government does have the resources to find out who people are.
All the time, I mean, and what they've done, where they've been, and everything like that. How do they do that?
Well, if you want to know some of it, there are these three hackers that were arrested about 2 days ago, and the FBI's indictments are online. They're on the Guardian's website, and you can read them and you can see how they've tracked people down.
And found out everything about them?
Well, everything online about them.
Okay, so, but nobody really knows what the rules are, and surely there must, I mean, there's wonderful access, I mean, it's wonderful, we're given this enormous freedom, I mean, it's exciting to be able to back online and communicate all the time. So, are we going to have to sacrifice some of that? Sacrifice some of those freedoms, I mean, are you very careful about, do you want my bank?
I do want my bank, yes. I'm not worried about that. I mean, for me, the point is more about worrying about the government more than the hackers. I mean, the thing about that is that there are always criminals around, and by all means, the state should investigate those criminals. But what seems to be happening is the energy is going into hackers who are challenging the authorities, not about hacking credit cards, but about challenging authorities about what they're doing.
Okay. All right, well, let's go on to the very obvious thing, which is national security, which is all the defense for blocking information or
presenting. I should like to talk to Stella Rubington.
Well, you stay on Stella Rubington, you can stay on Stella Rubington. But obviously that is, I mean, a truth mainly the first casualty of war, but clearly, you know, the prosecution of war requires privacy, requires not sharing. Government should be allowed to, surely, government should be allowed to investigate private information in order to prevent terror acts and terrorism.
Completely agree, and even myself as an investigative journalist, I want to keep my sources private. The problem I find is that, as I said in the silent state, why does the government understand why it's necessary to have a certain level of privacy? You have to conduct business in private. And yet, when it comes to the private citizen, they think we don't deserve the same respect. You know, we don't get any privacy. If we communicate, it has to be under surveillance, whether or not there's probable cause.
But what's the alternative? What's
the alternative is that the state cannot interfere with a private citizen unless they have probable cause and committed a criminal act. I mean, I think that's pretty basic enlightenment values. It just shocks me how our world has just ditched enlightenment values wholesale.
And how would you define, how would you define enlightenment values?
Open justice, the rule of law, the right to privacy, the right to not be interfered by the state, unless the state has probable cause.
But the state would argue they did have probable cause, wouldn't they?
For?
Well, for in the investigation of somebody, let's take a typical racist example, somebody in Oldham who they suspect of, who's bought 20 tons of fertilizer.
Well, if they get a warrant out, sure, but the whole idea of what's happening is that an ISP has to keep everyone's traffic. Everyone's traffic. It doesn't matter. There's no probable cause that you are a criminal. You're actually, you are, by the way they treat you, a potential criminal. That's how we are now. We're potential criminals. And so the state is allowed to keep our records.
And we should know, and obviously, and one of your great habits is that we should know what they are, what they've got.
Right.
And so should we assume they have everything?
Yes.
We should all assume they know everything about us.
Not that they know everything about us, but this is talking about digital, yes. Our online footprint, yes. Yeah. A lot of those records are kept. I mean, I'm not saying that there's a lot of incompetence, obviously, in bureaucracy. So that's always a great savior for individual liberties.
Yeah.
I wanted to say something about national security. The point about national security is that it's this governments argue they need to do things in order to protect the nation. Well, what is a nation but a series of values? And in a democratic society, those values are open justice, the rule of law, the right to privacy, not to be interfered with unless there's probable cause. So the state then ditches those values. I don't see how it can justify its national security issue.
Okay, well let's reverse it on talking about whistleblowers. So Barry Manning sees this Apache helicopter on the raid and releases it. Okay, so that is technically illegal. But you're arguing that block that's in the public interest. We have the right to release that information. That's our information, not the government's.
Well, I mean, Bradley Manning, if he is indeed the leader, which is, he still has his trial, it's interesting because there were several tranches of information that were leaked. Certainly, I think with the Apache video, and I don't know if people are familiar with that, but it was a video of American soldiers in an Apache helicopter getting down people in for me, it all hinges on public interest. I think there was a public interest in that being made public because it was no operations were being endangered by publishing that video. It was several years old when it was published. And there was quite a good reason for it to be shown. Then there was a series of other leaks, and it became cables and the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs. And I think within them there was certainly public interest material which should be published. But to publish all of it was quite irresponsible, which is why when the newspapers came to do it, we did it selectively.
Yes. Okay. Well, the thing about WikiLeaks is it's complicated, isn't it? Because it's now being confused with the personality of Julian Assange at the same time. Do you think it would have been easier if Julian Assange had been a less controversial figure?
Yes. it's hard. I mean, it's hard to know because the kind of personality traits that make a person do what they do, is also what makes them incredibly hard to get along with. But yeah, I do feel that this is a big problem because. If you look at WikiLeaks, what was the end result? The end result is that we have a raft of laws now going through all countries which are tightening up the internet, making us less free, making it more difficult to whistleblow, to leak information. So the whole point, as far as I understood it about WikiLeaks, was to change society, make it more open, try and make the argument to government that people have a right to see information. And you can't always use national security if that means
but it's increasingly hard, as we saw, it's increasingly hard to protect your sources, isn't it? So people who go to the people who expose the government secrets, people who are in government, they are doing very hard for them not to be traced. Is that right?
Yes, it is. I mean, it was even then. It was even with WikiLeaks. I mean, again, that promise that WikiLeaks made was not true. It didn't remain anonymous on the internet. And that was, again, I feel kind of an irresponsible thing that he did. He promised this degree of safety to sources, which he couldn't deliver. It's not deliverable on the internet. So I feel like he's done a lot of damage to the cause, actually. Yeah, that there was definitely a shift after the MP6 expenses and after the Iraq video, the Apache helicopter video, where you could see that the tide was turning and you could see that the kind of moral value was that people had a right to know what governments were doing, particularly when they were going to war. That you know, in a democratic society, if we mandate our government to go to war, we have a right to know how it's been behaving. But then afterwards, it just all became so drowned out in one person's in one man's personality and his petty little vengeance campaigns against newspapers who didn't write these hagiographies that he wanted, and he kind of waged war against them. It's really sad. It lost. He had his window when a lot of legislation could have been changed and whole mood could have been changed, and it.
Do you? I'm hoping that's it, please, really, because I'm. Do you think? Were you at all suspect sexual? I realise we're in a bit of Dr. Grant. Sexual harassment charges against him were rigged. I mean, when they were deliberately raised in order to get him.
From what I saw, his personality, no.
Because he came on to you.
He did, and I found him to be pretty intriguing, but strange person, and didn't really get, I say in my book, you know, maybe it's too much to expect somebody who made their name as an international hacker to understand personal boundaries, but that was definitely what I felt about him. So I don't think that those claims were illegitimate. I think they were probably true. And however, the way it was kind of dealt with in the courts, the fact that the Interpol Red Notice came out, you know, a few days after we at The Guardian published all of the diplomatic cables, it made it really easy for him to conflate his personal... it made it very easy for him to conflate the publishing of the cables with what had happened in Sweden. And they're totally separate things.
Yes.
They're totally separate things. And that, to me, is another big problem, is that you've got this great moral cause, which is WikiLeaks, and then you have a man who has some moral issues. And I think that that's wrong to try and use the morality of the cause to avoid personal responsibility.
Like I said, in past cases, we have so much information that it's very hard to find focus at times about what's important and what's not. So the focus is always shifting because the public and the media, particularly the media, want so much information, more and more information all the time without it being edited or without being not edited but interpreted. I mean, surely your job is to interpret this great mass of information. You know, since 2000, isn't it true that we have more information since 2003 than from the dawn of time to 2003?
I think Eric Schmidt, the old CEO, said that. Yeah, and that's true. But for me, it's about meaningful information, and that's why I'm hopeful that there is a future profession for journalists, because who is going to interpret all that information? I mean, I don't know that anybody in this audience wants to go look at these paint bins where all the hackers, they hack some information from a police department. And they don't know what it means, and they just throw it all up on a paste bin. You're not going to go and, like, troll through that. I mean, you might do if you, like, need...
What is a paste bin? Does that sound like a high school high-court judge? What is a paste bin? What is it?
What is this Facebook you're talking about? A paste bin is just an online thing where you just paste up information.
All your sources.
Like all the documentation. Yeah. And so that's, it's basically like all the raw material. And what a journalist does is you get all that raw material, but A, you check it, you try and verify that it's true and hasn't been tampered with or altered. But then you also pick up the telephone or go and talk to people to find out, you know, what somebody's in this cable, it says you're totally corrupt and that you've done all these dodgy deals. well, the way Assange does journalism is he just says, this person is corrupt. And it's like, well, no, somebody said they were corrupt. That doesn't mean it's true. Actually, I need to go and do some investigation to see, okay, what evidence is there that that person was corrupt? And that's really where the hard work of journalism comes in, because it's not just about regurgitating out this data that you find. It's about having to cross-reference, it's about interviewing people, it's about speaking up to them, and it's about getting some perspective as well on what's happened in the past.
Because not all this information is reliable. People know about people nicking each other's Facebook accounts and pretending to be other people. And it's the whole problem about this vast volume of digital information is that it can't be trusted.
Right, and I mean, I'm quite interested. If I was going to do another book, which I don't know if I will, it depends how many people buy this book, it's about propaganda, because I'm curious to know, in this like information age, do we know more or do we know less? Are we closer to the truth or are we further away from it? And I think it's hard to tell, because people aren't paying for investigative journalism. We get a kind of journalism which is instantaneous, and we don't always know who the sources are. We don't sort of cross-reference it, we don't verify it. I heard a really interesting thing, it's a bit on tangent, but an old lawyer's reporter, he's like 7 years old, he was talking about when he was hired, and his boss said, we're not just paying you for what you write, what you put in on the wire, we're also paying you for what doesn't go on the wire. Which is all the stories he checked out that turned out not to be true, or turned out to be just, you know, phony, or just garbage, or rumor, or innuendo. Well, now people are doing that. Everything's going on there. So, and something could be going across the world, a story, before even the first fact-checking has been done.
Yes, and that's a frontage of, obviously, one advantage of digital communication is that people are doing videos on their mobile phones of what's going on in Homs or what's going on in Damascus. And you see it with the media, but the other disadvantage is that people are reporting completely wildly, blogging, and you know whether to trust those blogs or not.
Yeah, I was at a UNESCO conference, and the head of digital media from Al Jazeera was there. He was talking about during the Arab Spring, they had 18,000 videos came in from different, just men and women in the street, you know, these videos. And somebody has to go through these 18,000 videos to see which ones tell a story, which ones are legitimate. A lot of them are too violent, they can't show them. How do they verify them? So with the best ones, they try and get somebody on the ground to go to the scene and make sure that, like, yeah, that landmark is actually in that place.
But that just takes time, and the pressure on news is to deliver now, tonight. Or tonight, they don't want to wait 2 weeks and watch 18,000 videos, do they? News bloggers don't want to do that. Want something out of that.
Yeah.
Okay, look, this is definitely your turn to ask some questions.
Two things briefly. Could you say a little bit more about the Surat video of the helicopter? Because I haven't heard that previously. But my other question is, it is said that the Freedom of Information Act makes it harder for government to reach sensible decisions because we can ask for the background papers, etc., within weeks or months. Could you comment on that, please?
Okay. So the video, first of all. So this is, if you read my book, which I highly recommend, it tells a whole story about that video and how it came into existence and how it was leaked and what it is. But just in brief, it was in the cockpit of these helicopters, they have a camera and it films what's happening. And because there was, I think it was 8 or 12 people were killed in this particular engagement, and two of them were Reuters cameramen. And it was investigated by the US Army, but nobody was charged with anything. Anyway, one of the things Brad Manning's piece is looking is this video. He found it, he was an intelligence analyst, and he found it in the computer, and looked at it and thought it was an app. Like, so, I mean, if you watch it, it's on the internet, you can see it on YouTube.
It's 17 minutes, it's collateral WordPress.
It is quite shocking, you can see it.
So for the free moment.
Yes, and the free moment commission. Well, it depends if you think that governments want to justify their decisions in the public or not. Tony Blair wasn't, he signed a contract for the NHSRT program, and that was before any FOI, it was before the FOI law came into force. And he didn't make any notes about it, and that was a £12.4 million contract. So I don't think, I actually think we move into an age of accountability as we have information law, information access law, because before they had that law, they didn't feel that they weren't mandated to be accountable to the public. They didn't have to respond. If you asked how much money did this contract, it's not going to tell you. Whereas now, they have to.
Peter John, I guess I'd have to be classified as one of the frontline activists that you describe in your book, which I've read and enjoyed. Thank you very much. I've been involved in the campaign against Form. For those who don't know about Form, Form is an advertising system that works by altering your internet communications, establishing a profile of you and using that to target advertising at you. And that's something that was trialled on thousands and thousands of BT internet customers covertly in 2006, 2007, and 2008. And it's currently being tested in Romania and Brazil. What I was hoping to ask is, I'd hope to read something about that in your book. I'm interested to know what you think about Form and why, what perspective you have on it. And then also a second question. The Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act should make it absolutely illegal for somebody to intercept communications without a warrant or consent. And yet nobody was prosecuted over those trials. Nobody faced any kind of criminal justice sanction. Do you have any thoughts about the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act?
I didn't write about Form because my book is more global. I think the Silent State isn't just about Britain, but with the revolution when we digitized, it's about the world and everything in it. So, and if I focus on any one country, it's probably America. And so when you read the book, when I talk about surveillance law, I use America as the example because it has the best codified law around surveillance. Which isn't to say it's great, because I give all of the flaws on it. The problem with RIPA, this law, is that it's incredibly murky, and it's not, it's murky, it's difficult to understand, and the main problem is it's also not enforced. So I remember doing an FOI request to Staffordshire Police, and it was about these flying CCTV cameras, and one of them flying around the festival. And I wanted to know, did it have a warrant? Did they have a warrant to do that? Because they meant to. And initially, the first thing that happened was a policeman from Staffordshire Police phoned me up and said, "Oh, who are you? Why do you want to know this?" Which is actually illegal, because when you make an FOI request, it's meant to be purpose blind, and they don't need to know anything about you. So I told him that. He's like, I just thought maybe you were a vendor. And I said, no. Anyway, then I got the answer back, and he said that it had been approved by the Surveillance Commissioner. No, it had been approved by the Information Commissioner. So then I phoned up the Information Commissioner, and he said, "Oh no, well, we never gave that approval." So then I went back to the police. They said, "Oh no, I made a mistake. It was the Surveillance Commissioner." So then I called the Surveillance Commissioner, and they also said, "Well, we've been in contact with them, but we haven't given any permission." But nothing happened at all. I mean, nothing happened. There was no sanction.
And presumably nothing's happened about the BTI. We can talk about that afterwards. But I mean, it does sound completely cool. At some point, just immediately.
Well, I think that's because there's no. wealthy lobby who lobbies for that law, for those laws to be enforced in Parliament. If we were in the record industry, we might have good enforcement. But the general public is not organized enough or interested enough or well-resourced enough to put pressure on Parliament to actually enforce these surveillance laws.
Yeah. Well, very, very well.
It'd be really fascinating because all I still hear, and I talk about digital economy a lot with people, is still a whole load of contradictions, which is that it's great to have the freedom of information out there, but then there's no controls. Controls is the wrong word, but validating that information, people questioning, triangulating the information isn't there. If you talk to the public, they on one hand want that information, on the second hand they don't want it to contradict security and cause the deaths of soldiers. So we've got a whole lot of questions of which all this creates lots of different minds, and it's very difficult for the public to actually engage with on which side of that fine line they are, and what they would be happy with and they wouldn't, and what true freedom is, because you have that picture of the lady there, and I see her moving away from being controlled on the internet, but into the arms of corporate business who are collecting all sorts of other information from her. So there's a huge lot of contradictions, and how are we ever going to be able to have a public debate that allows us to air those and work out what it is that we all really want, and what freedom truly is on the web, and how we also educate people to know that not everything is true, and that there is a really important value to the work that you do and the investigations that you do. There is true value to what artists do and what should be paid for, and all of those things. And I feel a little closer to knowing how we should move forward on that debate.
Yeah, I don't think you're alone. I think a lot of people feel in that space, and particularly for artists, for creative people, how they're living. I mean, I'm in that boat. I don't know how to fund my next project. I find investigative journals and newspapers is sort of down in the pan, which is why I wrote books, but now publishing is sort of like in crisis. So now I look to kind of academia. A lot of people are looking at these crowdsourcing funding mechanisms like Kickstarter. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it's called Kickstarter.com, and writers or artists, they put up a project and they say, I want $2,000 to write this book or whatever.
But actually, I think the most important thing you asked was, how do we know what's true? How do we know what's true? We're just given so much information. How do we find? Do we need trusted guides? Do we need to go? We write for the Guardian. Obviously, this is sponsored by the Independent. Obviously, we're the Independent first.
Well, one of the things that I'm very keen on is a renaissance of civics, and by that I mean teaching people how society works and what are the values of a democratic society? Like, I talked about the Enlightenment, and I don't know. Somehow that makes me really old-fashioned. But I think technology is moving all the time, but what doesn't change are the values. And the values are meant to be Enlightenment values, and those don't change. So it's with horror that I listened to the Attorney General in America trying to justify extrajudicial killing of Americans around the world. And I think, but hang on, the whole country of America, I'm a dual citizen, by the way, America and British. The whole point of America is about the rule of law. It's about the state not being able to do stuff like that unless, you know, there's the rule of law, people are innocent, people are proven guilty, they get to go to trial, they get to see the evidence that's against them, they can challenge it, and then if they're found guilty, they face the consequences. So this all seems to be, somehow, because we've got technology now, it's as if we throw out all those values. And that seems to be what's happening at the moment. It's just too many people think, oh, the law is too slow. You know, everything's moving at such an accelerated pace in the world. And the law isn't. The law is too slow. So let's just ditch it. Let's get rid of it. And let's just go off and kill people. And I think, well, this is the whole point. We've forgotten about civic society structure, what is the point of democracy, what are the values of democracy. So I do feel there's a kind of a need to sort of come back to basics.
Without the basics, two more very quick questions. If you'd like. Yes, you'd like a question.
Do you think we all need to have this identity, what's it called, full protection identity insurance stuff?
What is that? I don't know what that is.
You mean identity, but you mean private identity insurance?
Yes.
Identity theft.
Yes, my credit card company.
Yeah, all that. The things that cost £7 a month.
Yes, particularly if you're like me, I don't shop on the internet, I don't bank on the internet, I don't know that's about it, so am I a risk?
You're supposed to be protected anyway by your bank.
Yeah, I think so.
I
absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. It's a general, it's basically a general bank. Could you just take the microphone to that man?
Ian Honeywell, I work for Digital Agency here at Bath. I probably qualify you as a freedom warrior, if that's not too far. Your eventual program is freedom.
Freedom
of exchange of information by people without borders or without borders. That's great for the good people talking to each other, but of course that doesn't stop the bad people from talking to each other. So it seems that perhaps there's a need for a line to be drawn somewhere. Or is there? Should there be any line?
I think I expressed that. I'm not saying that people who commit criminal acts should get away with it. By no means. If you've committed a criminal act, then you face the consequences. All the internet is a communications medium. It's not immoral or moral. It's what people do on it that is either a criminal offence or not. The point of what I talk about is, are people innocent or are they potential suspects? And that's the problem, is we now look at the internet. States are looking at the internet and looking at everyone as a potential suspect. They're not looking at them as free citizens, or they have a right to be left alone unless we find probable cause if they're guilty of a criminal offence. No, it's that we are all potential suspects online, and we have no right to challenge them, we can't challenge that. So for me, that is not democratic. And also, I think it's a waste of resources, actually. It's lazy policing, and lazy policing never is very efficient. If you look at the countries where they have blanket surveillance, it's not that they don't have any crime. You can look at Russia, and they have pretty good surveillance of their internet, and so does China. And I don't think they've gotten rid of crime. So it's surveillance is not about making people safer. It's about control, and it's about power.
It's easy for being on the street. It's not too easy to be on the street. You can be away from it. I suppose it's about whether people are about to be bad. That's the real problem. It's not whether people are good or bad. It's about suspicion that people are about to be bad. And you're saying that's the problem about the state. You're that the
yes,
surveillance
I
is assuming
everyone's bad. I don't
even
know why this is considered a radical statement. I mean, the whole argument of the ability of American Constitution was all about this. It was all about what are the rights of the state, what are the rights of the police.
Do you think actually we've moved from an age of innocence until proven guilty, that surveillance is guilty until proven innocent?
Yeah, I do. And that's, to me, that is the danger, that we are sort of superficially accepting what the security services tell us, which is, we're only doing this for your benefit. You know, we're doing this for benevolent reasons. No, they're not. They're doing it for reasons of power, for control, and sometimes, sometimes commercial gain. And the point is, we only have to look at history to see that the concentration of power has always been, particularly by the state, has always been the biggest danger to humanity.
Yeah, well, that's very, very cheery, isn't it? Heather's going to be outside. The Revolution Will Be Digitized is a fantastically, people say books are timely. It's a really timely book. It's rather alarming. It's brilliantly written. Thank you, Heather.